Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Oval House Theatre. Thank you for staying for this post-show discussion with Cobus Moorman, the author of Full Circle. Cobus is an award-winning playwright and poet, and lectures in creative writing at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in his home country of South Africa.
The play started in mid-2004 when I quite literally won day, I don't know, night, morning. I had no idea, but I heard the words of someone speaking inside my head. And the words were as follows: I can see, in the darkness I can see. Those are the words I heard. And these words kept playing in my mind over and over again. And then I didn't know who was speaking these words, and I needed to find out, well, who is speaking? How can this person see? And then I slowly began to answer myself. Yes, she can see. I didn't know if it was a man or a woman. I thought I made up that it was a woman. She can see because she cannot see. All right? So there's a sense of paradox. And for myself as a writer, I like to work out of paradox. It creates a kind of energy for me. If I know what things mean, if I can solve them, there's nothing for me to write into. If I think of myself writing with my eyes closed and walking into the darkness as a writer, I do not know where I go as a writer. I follow where the words lead. And it was through Macy that the play began. And that I then began to ask myself questions. Who is she? Who is there with her? Is she alone? Where is she? Ah, she has a brother. Is he older than her? Younger than her? What is their relationship? Who else is there with her? Does she have a father? No, she doesn't have a father. Why doesn't she have a father? What is the other male? Are there other male presences in her life? Yes, there is. There is her uncle. What happened to the father then? Ah, he died. How did he die? He was murdered. And this is how the play developed, by me asking myself questions and then answering. So I never knew from the beginning of the play, as I wrote, where the play was leading. It took quite literally, and I'm not joking with you, the play went through 16 drafts. Because of the strange way that I write, where I do not know where I'm going, once I get to the end once I got to the end of the first draft, I suddenly realized, oh, that's what happens. Now I know what happens. And then I had to go back and change things. So it's a matter of creating levels in the play. Each draft was putting in was a matter of soaking in different levels of the play that then permeated and sunk down into the play. And at each different point I would discover new things about the character and then have to go back to the beginning of the play and write those little moments in to be able to make those kinds of connections. The play emerges for me out of an area that I'm particularly concerned with, which is the area of extremism in some sense, or whatever form that extremism might take, whether that extremism is nationalism or political extremism, and particularly the confluence. What happens at the confluence, the merging at that point where political, national, and religious fundamentalisms come together? What do they create? What kind of warping do they actually set in motion? And as a writer, I feel it is not for me to dictate to you what you should feel about the characters, to create evil characters or good characters. I don't believe that those distinctions exist in human beings. It is the play itself, it is the unfolding of the narrative that needs to pass judgment on the characters. Not me as a writer. I cannot pass judgment on them. It's the story. The unfolding is the judgment on the characters. I think that's enough as I can say at the moment as a way of opening into the play, leading into the play. I'd like now to open the floor to you if there's any questions or even just areas of discussion, things that you'd like to comment on. Please, this is your chance to ask any questions or make any comments if you'd like.
During those 16 drafts, did you go and do a lot of research, or was it all in your head, and did you just kind of keep writing it over and over again, and did you talk to people? What was the process through those 16 drafts?
It was often a mix of a lot of different things. Once I realized what the myth, that myth is actually the incorrect word, although I use the word myth, when I use the word myth, I'm not speaking about something that isn't true, okay? I'm speaking about something that lives on in the culture, in the consciousness of people. So once I realized that I was using the myth of Nonkawuse, let me explain that to you, to some members of the audience. In 1856, a Xhosa maiden, Xhosa prophetess, she was very young, she was probably about, I've seen photographs of her, she was probably about 14, 15 years old. She was down at the river. It's a sacred river on the eastern Cape Coast, and she claims that some figures came out of the bush, dressed in white. They were painted white, and they spoke to her, and they said to her that she must go back to her people, and she must tell them that they must suspect, that they must burn all their fields, burn all their crops, they must slaughter all their cattle. There's a series of events. At that particular moment in history, there was a great plague and a sickness that was affecting the cattle. The sickness had, of course, been brought across by the colonialists and had that spread. And so, of course, all the African cattle hadn't developed
immunity.
Thanks. Hadn't developed immunity, and they were dying. And so she said to people that, okay, if they killed all the cattle and burnt all the crops, a new herd of cattle would actually arise out of the ground. That was her first prophecy. There were several prophecies that she went through. One of the last prophecies, in fact, was then where she then went back to the people, because she met these ancestors several times. They appeared to her several times. The last prophecy where they actually then said to her, if you do this, and if you convince the people to do this, you will get new herds, clean herds, they will be free of disease, and the white colonialists will return to their ships and disappear from the shore, and they'll never be seen again, and the land will be yours forever and ever. And it took quite a bit of convincing, obviously. there were several camps or sort of divisions in the community, some believing her, some not believing her. And so eventually in 1858, it led to the great Xhosa cattle killings, where sections of the community did slaughter their cattle, literally in the hundreds, if not thousands. It literally happened. And it led to starvation. That's what it led to. Starvation, death, and the enslavement of the people, because they couldn't support themselves, and they ended up becoming servants and slaves to the white colonialists, the very thing that she claimed would actually free them from it. had actually enslaved them. And at some particular moment in the writing of the play, I just knew. At the beginning of the play, I didn't know what Macy's vision was. But as I wrote, and then, of course, I had to go back and then change a line, change moments of it. So once I knew what she was actually seeing. But it then became very, very clear to me. I turned the myth around. Macy claims that if her people, this particular grouping, destroy all their fields, kill the cattle, that the Africans will leave the country and the whites will have the land back. But it's not their land. So it's a way of revealing the twistedness, the warpedness, I think, of that particular way of seeing the world. I feel that my writing is moving towards something, so I need to write this out, to write through this, to arrive at a point that I do not know what this point will be. But that's what, it's a matter of me finding out what I'm going to say as I end up saying it, knowing that I haven't yet said it. There's that awful thing for a writer that you wonder, you know, will I ever get the point of being able to say what I really, really, really want to say? And that's a terrifying thing as a writer, because you think, no, that's not what I want to say. That's not what I mean to say. It's not like that, it's something else. So these are all imperfections. They glance off it.
Can you tell us how the play was received in South Africa?
Yes, it was actually received very, very well. It was received very well. It won an award and it was extremely well received in Grahamstown, and then went on to Maritzburg, Hilton Arts Festival, and to the Market Theatre in Johannesburg. And I think there's certain kind of resonances, perhaps, in amongst the audience, that they clicked in with certain things. But I also feel, and this is what I've been very interested in seeing how the play works here, is that I am not writing for a South African audience. I think that would be a great limitation on any author. And I do believe that the play does speak beyond that. It might come out of that particular historical moment, that cultural moment, but I think it should be able to move past that and connect with other things that are happening, other resonances around the world.
Extremism.
Well, exactly. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And the role of religion, let me be more correct, a type of religion, a view of religion, which is shared by this particular family. That view of religion is a view that I'm wanting to examine and look at and actually judge in a way.
I think it works. For me, the most interesting bits are the religious aspects. One, because of the ability of the religion is now, I mean, so much of a vital part in politics over the last 8 years in particular. And the play does resonate and go beyond the borders of South Africa. And I think that the other important issue is that now culture is being defined. Years ago, it was politically, now it's very much religion is defining culture very much, especially the type of American stuff that we're getting, that's become very infectious. So I found those bits in the play really, really, really interesting, because I know from studying South African history, I know religion played a major part in the building of apartheid, sure, and sustaining it. Sure. And so it's, especially with the order that we've got now, it does work religiously. And those parts I found very
interesting. Yeah, I mean, I'm fascinated that in this era of globalization, as national boundaries start disappearing and national identities start blurring, we suddenly find people falling back onto a kind of, or seeking some kind of absolute to hold on to, and one of these would become religion as a way of trying to say, no, I'm this at the exclusion of everything else. And I think it's something that we need to look at from all different points of view, because it certainly is affecting the world we live in right now.
Yeah. I mean, it always has done, but it's now.
Exactly.
It's now becoming more bold.
Yeah.
More bolder than before.
Yeah. Good point. Yeah.
Seeing your play done now again, and obviously coming from South Africa and re-seeing the second time seeing you being here. As a writer, do you feel like there's stuff that you've missed out, or stuff that you put too much in and you'd want to take back? I mean, do you feel like it's complete as a piece of work?
That's an interesting question, and it's a scary thing. Even tonight I was sitting in the audience, I was thinking, oh no, hang on, I must take that line out, it doesn't work. But I think that there must come a point, there has to come a point for a writer where you do actually stop. And irrespective of the imperfections, etc., you do actually say no. I can't keep tinkering with this thing, because you'll just carry on forever and ever and ever. I don't know where that point comes, but at some point, and I think that's what one strives with in all of one's work, one's writing, is for the piece to ultimately leave the writer. That's what I seek in all of my writing, so that I'm no longer there in the work. And it's perhaps more obvious in drama, in theatre, that the author is not there. But that for me is a sign of a work that has integrity, that has strength, is if it doesn't need its author to explain it, to talk about it, to support it. The work must be able to stand on its own feet. And I believe that, I know the play does stand on its own feet. So once it's got to that point, then I think I must then actually leave it. I can tinker, but that doesn't matter, you know. It stands by itself. It now has left me and is living its own life. That's beyond me.
With writing a post-colonial piece, was it difficult writing for what most people would see as the negative characters, sense that they are doing the thing most people would say was the wrong choice. Yeah. Is it difficult to write from that perspective?
That's a good question too. It worried me, not as a writer, as a South African writer, committed to the struggle as I was, and then I thought, well, how can I write about these kind of people? They're like, is it right to write about these kinds of people? Because I didn't like them. You know, they're not. They. Yeah. But I came to a decision early on in the writing process that I had to actually create them as fully rounded human beings. So that, yes, ultimately at some point you do feel sorry for them. You might not like them. You don't like them, that's fine. But you can feel sorry for them. And that for me is an interesting place to lead the reader, to lead an audience to. So it returns to what I was saying earlier, you know, I'm not here creating evil characters, I don't think they exist. We all have these different sides within us, different aspects, elements, some more than others. These characters are more obviously lost or lost in violence or whatever. It took a bit of soul searching, because I was afraid to go into that world, and that's when I had to do a little bit of research. Obviously, I mean, I come from an Afrikaner community. My father is Afrikaans, my mother is English. So I have not just not nearly as these people are. They are ultra right wing, and they are a minority, but they are there. Okay, so I don't know people like this, but I can understand where they come from. Let me put it that way. I can express it that way. I did have to do a little bit of research. There were kinds of interesting Afrikaner seers, as Macy is a seer, as Nongawuse was a seer. There was an interesting Afrikaner seer called Siner van Rensburg, Siner Seer van Rensburg, who emerged during the Anglo-Boer War. He wasn't blind, but he was an extremely uneducated man who lived an extremely simple life, barefoot, hardly had any clothes, lived just a very, very poor life, and had the most strange visions, really strange visions. And it's up to posterity to judge whether these things are true or not. It's like Nostradamus, you know, you could read into it whatever you like, really, I think. So that was a bit of a tangent. Thank you.